Whatever doesn't kill me should probably start running.
This is the Blackwater Ethercast.
If what is generally known about North America is taken as true, one expects to find gleaming metropolises of wealth and culture in the East and South, mechanical marvels in Texas and California, and great deserts and prairies between them. I had presumed by now that the Wild West at least had been tamed. It is a land of great promise for the future, but very little history of note, with only recent cities and industrialization, and before that, simple primitive existence stretching back to the dawn of time. But now, I begin to wonder. There is much more here than anyone has hinted, and far more than meets the eye. I see now the edge of a strange and untold history, and I may perhaps be in one of the strangest centers of this history, where it lies barely under the surface of a long-established city. I am in New Orleans. This venerable port, with a long-established reputation for discretion, is the perfect place for my supply line to move from land to sea. Not that I have very much in mind that any government would object to my transporting to Great Britain, but one never knows. Circumstances change. Laws change, with annoying irrationality. And sometimes one's own country, where one is a peer of the realm, applies tariffs apparently designed to limit one's abilities. Actually, I have some information suggesting exactly that. So, one does what one must to assure affordability. Yes, I regularly take money and interesting items from other members of the peerage, but that is mere entertainment, and on an entirely different scale than the needs which have brought me across the Atlantic. I have also brought a few of the personnel who will be involved with the Daedalus Project, the primary aim of this excursion. They are necessary experts and consultants, of course, but quite apart from that. Without them, my bizarre discoveries would likely not have happened. The evening we arrived, I made the mistake of remaining in the chosen restaurant for a while after dinner, instead of retiring to my room for an evening's postprandial cup. Wellesley insisted that he should remain with me as protection in this unknown new place, and McThomas interacted with the restaurant staff, leaving me to quietly ponder upcoming dealings with the Texas gas fields and sip an intriguing local cocktail called a Sazerac. My enjoyment was interrupted by a broad-shouldered, bluff and cheerful fellow with a U.S. Marshal's badge on his coat and an absurd mustache under his nose.
"Well, sir, if you ain't the fanciest thing this fancy restaurant has seen in a fair while."
Without prompting or invitation, he dropped into the empty seat opposite me. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Wellesley shift, but I raised my hand to stay him. "I see that you are a lawman."
"And I hear that you are an Englishman," he replied, his smile pivoting the halves of his mustache to look exactly like an albatross mid-flap.
"I am Baron Blackwater, at your service."
"A baron? Well, your eminence, I am Marshal Eben Paxton at yours. At this whole region's service, really, outside the city anyway. They have their own law enforcement, of course."
"You don't sound particularly New Orleans, Marshal."
"Well, several years in the Carolinas will rub off on you. I was assigned there for some time, carrying out the directives of Congress and serving my country to the best of my ability. So much so that they finally agreed to send me back home to serve areas that needed me more. Not exactly home, of course. I grew up in Lafayette, but I have family in New Orleans and a fondness for the city in general. Perhaps after a few years I'll sound like one of the locals again. In the meantime, I like to joke that I've got the extra duties, so I got me a gun that can do extra duty. A 7-shot revolver, if you can believe that."
It was clear that I would have to be careful in what I said around this man. The least comment could easily set him off on a half-hour's verbal meandering. On the other hand, if I ever needed to extract information from him, I could get anything I wanted without his ever realizing it. He interrupted his aimless narrative and my thoughts, again, with a sudden interest in my beverage.
A Sazerac, is it? Fine drink, if a little fancy for my taste, but a fine New Orleans drink anyway.
He steepled his fingers across his chest, leaned back, and adopted what I'm sure he thought was an erudite and thoughtful expression.
Now, everyone knows that Americans make whiskey. Some of it's raw gut, sure, but there are also some very fine examples. That rye in your cup. Some very nice selections from Bourbon County in Kentucky. But by my lights, the quintessential American drink, the one people drink more of and keep coming back to, is beer. If you're going to spend time in these United States, you must experience the beer. Garcon, bring us a pair of Dixies.
Beer. American beer.
Yes, sir. A good American lager.
No.
Now, you mustn't deny it till you try it. Ah, here we are. My brother works in the Dixie Brewery over on Tulane. He says that no one who's tasted it can resist its charms.
I took a reasonable pull of the beer and considered it for a moment, then set down the glass. Allow me. McThomas quietly sighed and shook his head slightly. Paxson's face darkened.
You don't like it?
I got the impression that I had insulted his mother.
The pride of Nolan's brewing, and you don't like it?
I much prefer the rye whiskey, yes, which you may note I had before you arrived.
Who do you think you are, Baron? Too good for American beer? Too good to spend time with a U.S. Marshal? You are a rude and small-minded individual, dare I say a perfect example of your class, which we had the good sense to eject from our society 140 years ago, entirely to our benefit since. I'm afraid my southern hospitality is nearly exhausted. I shall say good evening to you, sir, and I shall recommend that you stay carefully on the side of the law during your stay here.
He got up, glared at me, and, wordlessly for a change, stalked from the room. Ah, well, as they say, peace comes at a price. A good morning's progress ended in a luncheon meeting with the owner of a series of warehouses. Afterward, I gave my geological chemist, Mr. King, leave to visit the Dixie Brewery to find out about their brewing procedures, Wellesley having mentioned it to him. He is fascinated with all practical applications of chemistry, so I let him satisfy his curiosity. When he had not returned at the appointed time, I was naturally irritated, and sent a pair of the others to retrieve him. Perhaps he had discovered the joys of American beer, and required guidance to return. But they reported that while King had indeed made friends with the brewers, and had toured the facility with learned interest, no one had seen him leave, nor had any idea where he would have gone, if not back to us. This was rather unlike the always reliable Mr. King, and piqued my concern. I gathered my entourage and went to the area to see if we could find him. The brewery workers had no idea when or whence he had left, but a very old man with clothing nearly as antique caught our attention in the street outside. With voice and gestures equally unsteady, and an entirely baffling accent, he conveyed to us that he had seen our chemist leaving toward the downtown area, by which the locals mean downriver, while chatting with another man. Our ancient informant did not like the look of the other individual, though he seemed completely unable to explain why in any coherent fashion. The only thing we were able to understand was that King would be somewhere in the bayou that evening, and that we would need a knowledgeable guide if we were to find him in time. However we pressed him, the old man would not explain in time for what. He merely shook his head and hunched into his coat with obvious fear. The guide he recommended was to be found on Decatur Street, near a place called Jackson Square. We would recognize him by his unlikely hat. He would answer to the name Reb. We did indeed recognize his outlandish headwear at some distance, festooned as it was with bones, feathers, and unidentifiable artifacts. He swept it off his head in an equally extravagant gesture, bowing low and gracing us with a grin both obsequious and predatory.
"Good, sir, I do not yet know what it is that you need, but I am certain that I am the man who can get it for you."
"I certainly hope you are. You are Reb?"
"Why, yes, I am. I am pleased to hear that my reputation has brought the attention of such a gentleman as yourself. But just for my own curiosity, how did you find me so handily?"
"By your hat and your location. Though with a name like Reb, I rather expected the hat to be an old gray kepi from your civil war."
"Oh, no, sir. My family don't fight in no one's wars. We follow a path of peace, and soldiering would disturb our ways. Reb is short for Rebenac. I am John Rebenac, grandson of Dr. Jean Montigny, likewise a servant of the spirits and aid to my fellow man. How may I assist you, sir? Have you a sickness? Do you require counsel for the future or gree-gree for protection on your upcoming travels?"
"Nothing so exotic. My needs are both immediate and practical. One of my men has gone into the bayou, and we are informed that he must be found this evening, and that you are our best hope for doing so."
"On the bayou? Tonight? Someone has pulled my leg, I see. Sir, no reasonable person would, this evening, go out to..."
He trailed off and looked at me curiously. He raised his eyebrows, and his gaze flickered rapidly from one of my eyes to the other.
"Oh,"
he finally said.
"I see. My apologies. I had no idea. I must prepare for this venture. Meet me at my lodgings in 1 hour, and we will go find your man. But I must warn you, the waters hold worse things than alligators."
1 hour later, having equipped ourselves for a search in the water-filled swampland, we arrived at the address Reb had given us. It was a small apartment above his shop, which sold a variety of odd items to those who followed the voodoo religion, and rather silly items to tourists who wanted to think themselves worldly wise. The neighborhood was very old indeed, and inhabited almost exclusively by people who spoke very little English, preferring a strange and almost incomprehensible variety of French, mixed with other bits of languages. We were let into Reb's apartments as he stood at a table, placing small items into a pouch, sometimes making a gesture or pronouncing some foreign phrase before doing so. At the last, he touched water to his forehead, the back of his neck, and the pouch itself before closing it. His odd ritual concluded, he put the pouch into his right pocket, patting it from the outside as though to be sure it was there.
"Will you take a gree-gree bag, Baron? I'd feel much surer knowing you had some sort of talisman."
"No, that's quite all right. However, I do have a small talisman of sorts for you." I jingled the little bag containing his payment before tossing it toward the table. He caught it before it landed and shook his head.
"Not there, Baron."
He dropped it into a drawer at his dresser and took a deep breath.
"Shall we go, then?"
Today's entertainment is an inscription by Edgar Allan Poe. From childhood's hour, I have not been as others were. I have not seen as others saw. I could not bring my passion from a common spring. From the same source I have not taken my sorrow. I could not awaken my heart to joy at the same tone. And all I loved alone. Then, in my childhood, in the dawn of a most stormy life, was drawn for every depth of good and ill, the mystery which binds me still, from the torrent or the fountain, from the red cliff of the mountain, from the sun that round me rolled in its autumn tint of gold, from the lightning in the sky as it passed me flying by, from the thunder and the storm, and the cloud that took the form when the rest of heaven was blue of a demon in my view. People say the bayou when referring to the deep swamps near New Orleans, as though they were a single small region of its nearby landscape. But the truth is that the city is mostly surrounded by bayou, enough that for convenience of reference, it is divided into several bayous. Reb's alarmed recognition of where King had likely gone was the only reason we had any notion of which direction to look. In the gathering evening, the bayou seemed endless. Once in Reb's boat, our party proceeded at a moderate pace through the labyrinthine trees, stands of reeds, and small islands. Sometimes we would pass a rotting log floating in the moss-ridden water. Sometimes it only looked like a log until we saw the eyes at one end watching us pass. The little huts, built on tiny islands or perched like birdhouses on stilts just above the water, diminished in frequency as we moved toward the outer parts of the bayou. Finally, there was nothing but our boat and a calm, unfriendly wilderness. Reb throttled down his outboard motor to a slow putter, and the rest of us donned our night goggles, able to make a nearly moonless night appear as bright as if it were under a full moon. We rode along in expectant silence, accompanied only by the quieted engine and the calls of the nighttime creatures. The creature's sounds suddenly faded a few moments after we spotted a distant firelight. Reb turned the boat and brought us to a reed-choked inlet with a floating wooden dock. In hushed tones, he explained that we were at the far end of the same island as the light. We would be able to approach more cautiously and quietly without the boat's engine. A path wound its way between the darkened trees and silent undergrowth. As we drew nearer, the sounds of chanting became clear. But before we were close enough to see what was happening through the trees, a sudden thought came to me, and I flipped down the heat vision monocle over my left goggle. Sure enough, the yellow and orange shape of someone hiding in the brush appeared to me, merely a dozen yards ahead of us, and I recognized his unmistakable bulk and hat. I pointed to alert the others to his presence, then hurried to where he was. "Marshal Paxton, what the devil are you doing out here?" He jumped as though bitten, then furrowed his brows at us. "I'm being very quiet for one thing, and what the Sam Hill are you doing out here?" I briefly explained our mission, and a look of comprehension stole over him. "Ah, I see. You have come to find the very events I'm here to investigate. I must warn you that there are very dangerous, unpredictable people behind this kidnapping, and while I am well accustomed to this place and its dangers, you and your people would be best off retreating to the far end of this little island and leaving it to me." "You want to take on that entire group yourself? It sounds like they number at least a dozen. Surely we would be wise to combine our efforts. You said they were dangerous." "I also said I was a native son of this place and versed in its ways. I believe I can retrieve your man without injury and without fighting anyone at all. Of course, there was always my revolver should the discussion go badly. There was no need for you to..." The chanting suddenly rose in pitch and volume and tempo, seizing our attention. We instinctively knew that we would have to act quickly, and my group moved forward, nearly running, though in a crouch. Paxton followed close behind, objecting as loudly as he dared. The trail ended in a clearing by the sluggish water. About a dozen men and women, wearing more paint than cloth, danced in exultant incoherency around a fire edged in stones that jutted upward like teeth. Their leader stood beside a decorated slab of wood that bore a symbol made of swirls and angles. Her skirt was covered in geometric designs, and her upper body was covered by an enormous number and variety of beaded necklaces. She held bare arms above her headdress of feathers and bones and called out phrases in a language I could not guess at, and her dancers responded likewise. Just off the shore, in water only a few inches deep, Edgar King stood in his shirt and tattered remains of trousers, facing the blackness of the bayou, hands bound to a stout post on either side. Beside me, Reb muttered a prayerful phrase in Latin and took the little pouch from his pocket, hanging it round his neck as an amulet. Though his Creole skin made him harder to see than the British members of our party, the whites of his widened eyes stood out in the shadows. He clearly had a better idea than we of what we were about to witness. I decided that better there were nothing to witness at all. After a quick conference with Wellesley, we each drew our knives and disappeared into the brush, circling the clearing in opposite directions. I reached a tree at the waterline, only a few steps from the post to King's left, and saw that Wellesley was likewise ready on his far side. I was about to dash out when one of the women abruptly left the fevered dance and retrieved a small earthen pot from her leader. With a strange, exaggerated walk, she went to King, and with her hand painted a pair of stripes down his back with whatever inky substance it held, then drew similar lines on his front. Then she shoved his head backward and poured it onto his face. He struggled and tried to shout, even as he gagged on the stuff, but she had already turned away from him to face the darkness. She held the pot aloft, as though offering it to the sky, then threw it directly out into the bayou. Her task complete, she returned to the wild dance. Suddenly, the leader shouted something new, and the dancers instantly stopped, turned toward her, and knelt, bowing their heads in obvious reverence. For her part, the leader faced the slab of wood and began moving her hands and quietly chanting to it. This was the chance we needed. Wellesley and I got ourselves to Mr. King as quietly as the water allowed, and an instant later, he was free. He seemed dazed, but we wiped the blackish slime from his face, and when Wellesley motioned that he remain silent, he nodded. In the next moment, several things happened at once. Some distance behind me, I heard the rumble of water surging. In front of me, the assembly of people turned with arms outstretched in supplication toward where we were, still between the posts, only to pause and cry out in anger and alarm. King, still facing the water, was overcome by a quickly dawning expression of terror. He tried to talk, but could only sputter in stunned fascination. We had no time for that, but spun him in the right direction and bowled through the area toward the path. Something alerted the group's leader, and she looked in the direction of the rest of our party, pointing and shouting in the strange local French. We blustered through the clearing's exit, and the rest of the group turned toward the path to the boat. Paxton shouted, "No, this way!" and waved us toward a different path. Our confused hesitation and the vagueness of the darkened paths allowed our pursuers to catch up with us. A few of them ran down the path Paxton had taken. Though outnumbered, we held the rest of them off and prevented any of our group from being taken. However, when most of us escaped toward Reb's boat, the enemy in hot pursuit, Wellesley and I, still supporting a slightly dazed Mr. King, got separated from them. I suddenly realized that the dancers had to get to this island on boats of their own, and that they would likely be nearby. I chanced to look into the clearing, but no boats were visible. The dancer's leader remained by the painted slab of wood, bowing with her face to the ground, arms outstretched toward the now empty posts. I glanced at them to see what she could possibly be bowing toward, and almost dropped Mr. King, whose arm I held as he, in a small, terrified voice, repeated the phrase, "It's here, it's here, it's here, it's here." I could not fully comprehend what I saw out there, a huge dome of yellow-green bioluminescence, but I knew that if I did not soon look away, I would soon be unable to. The decision was made for me in any case. At that moment, a trio of our pursuers reappeared from down the trail and ran toward us. I drew the revolver I had removed from the marshal as we huddled in the brush earlier, and let fly a pair of bullets toward them. They dove for cover, and we hurried off down the remaining path. I wondered when Paxton would notice that his pistol had gone, but at that instant I heard a series of very American expletives in his booming voice from some distance behind us. I had to admit, it was a very nice gun. I could understand his annoyance. As hoped, at the other end of our new trail was a group of small boats like the one Reb had brought us in, moored to another floating dock. I helped King get into one, and Wellesley started the engine. We left with all haste. The next day, this morning, I found Reb at his shop, looking uncharacteristically sullen and haunted. He attempted pleasant conversation.
"Your people get back to you all right?"
"Yes, thank you. Who was that out there?"
"Well, if I'm right, there's a bit of a story. My grandpappy mentored a voodoo queen named Marie Laveau. Now, while she's still famous and feared, she was in her time, I think, a pretty good person. She was powerful, generous, and understood our place as regards the spirits. I see that you're a man of wealth and science, so I don't know if you're going to believe any of this. I don't care. This is what happened, and why those people were out there in the bayou with your man last night. You see, with voodoo, the spirits don't serve us. We serve them. Part of that, when you are doing things like telling the future, is opening yourself to them, like being possessed, but on purpose. The trouble is, if you're not careful, a bad one can come in instead of a good one. So we're always very careful about these things. Now, one of Marie Laveau's students, named Rosanet, was mostly interested in what Marie had to teach because she wanted power. She figured being a voodoo queen meant everyone would just do whatever you say, and for some of the bad ones, that's kind of true. But even then, most are smart enough not to go past what they can actually do. So Marie kind of held Rosanet back a little to keep her out of both kinds of trouble. But once Marie died, Rosanet thought, well, here's my chance to get ahead. As you might have guessed, somewhere along the line, she let the wrong one in. Honestly, I have no idea what spirit took her over, but it's not like anything I've heard of before. Neither was that symbol we saw last night. That woman out there on the bayou is probably Rosanet's daughter or granddaughter, keeping on with what they do. But what they do is awful. The worst and most evil people seem drawn to the group, and while they usually sort of look like they follow the form of voodoo, it's a twisted version of it, the kind of thing that gives us all a bad name. You know those dolls? The ones everyone thinks of when they hear the word voodoo? Did you know they're mostly used to benefit people? But Rosanet's people do horrible things with them. Things I didn't know you could really do. Seems like they make everything horrible. Maybe it's because of that horrible thing out there. What was that thing? He looked like a child who wanted to hide under a blanket during a thunderstorm. I don't know. What did you see? My own mind resisted summoning the recollection. It was a dome, several yards across, glowing like a firefly, but yellow-green. The color reminded me of an infected wound. There were things that looked like eyes, symmetrically placed, but the lids were vertical instead of horizontal, and there was no iris, just a huge pupil surrounded by what would be called the white of the eye, if it were white. And they were different sizes, and there were far too many of them. And because of the sickly glow, I could tell, even through the filthy water, that there was much more of the thing under the surface. Retelling it now, it seems merely grotesque. But even in describing it to Reb, my mind strained and revolted that such a thing could actually exist, and in no mere theoretical bestiary, but directly accounted to my unwilling senses. I don't know what it was, either.
Whatever it is, I sense that it is very, very old. How long it's been here, I cannot guess. Rosanet might have called it, or it might have called her. Either way, it's here now, and it will be a problem for you as long as you are here. If I understand what was happening, that ritual with the black slime was to bind your man to the thing. Hardly seems necessary if you're planning to feed him to it anyway, but rituals are like that sometimes. If it's able to receive that kind of connection, he should stay in the city for as short a time as possible. Anything more than a day, and who knows what might happen. I wasn't sure what to make of Reb's prognosis. I am disinclined to believe such things. But then, I would be incredulous that a huge glowing horror lived in the waters near a bustling city without everyone in the world knowing of it, except that I had seen it with my own eyes. Oh, I came across Marshal Paxton earlier today. He was mighty annoyed about things. Didn't blame me for any of it, or so he says, but he might become another reason for you to move on pretty quick. Whatever else went on between you, well, he wants his gun back.
The Blackwater Aethercast is written, produced, and performed by Nicholas Jovian. Additional voices by Kayla Thomas. Beginning and ending music is by Derek and Brandon Fichter. They can be found at dbfichter.bandcamp.com. Today's entertainment was Alone by Edgar Allan Poe. Be sure to subscribe to the Aethercast and send your friends to lordblackwater.com so they can too. A new chapter is released twice monthly. Also, visit lordblackwater.com to be the featured entertainment. and thanks for listening, wherever you are, whatever you are. Thank you.